This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. Last week, many of us would have read the shocking but perhaps not uncommon news of a 15-year-old girl who had given birth and allegedly caused the death of her newborn. Now, as more details emerge about the case, it was reported that the girl had been remanded while a police investigation is carried out. And that's a move that has been criticised by MPs and child rights advocates for not considering the child's right to protection, despite her having possibly committed a serious crime. Now, in a situation like this, how do we balance between addressing the crime while also protecting the child's rights? And when it comes to tackling teen pregnancies and baby dumping, or in some cases, infanticide, why is it important for us to take a child-centered approach rather than a criminal one? So joining me to discuss today's topic is Srividya Ganapati, co-chairperson of CRIB Foundation, which stands for Child Rights, Innovation and Betterment. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sri. Now, to begin, right, what do we know thus far about this case involving the 15-year-old girl?
Okay, so what I understand and what I've heard from child protection circles is that she was taken to the hospital after the friend, I think her friend reported the case, and then the child was taken to the hospital. And she was remanded in the hospital, meaning to say the remand proceedings took place in the hospital. And she was discharged from the hospital straight away into police custody and placed in police detention. The remand that was given was for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the next remand hearings is Wednesday.
And perhaps for people who are not familiar with what it means or don't fully understand, right, what does it mean? What happens to the child when she is remanded?
I mean, remand is basically when you're arrested, you have to be produced before a magistrate and the charge has to be read to the magistrate to say, this is the reason why I'm detaining this person under arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Remand, on the other hand, is where you're taking the person before the magistrate. As soon as police detains a person, within 24 hours, they're supposed to be brought before remand proceedings. And so you're brought for remand proceedings before the magistrate, whereby the police are asking, I mean, I'm just giving a very layman understanding of it. The police are basically asking the magistrate or the court for time to continue the investigations. So usually they will ask for up to 14 days to carry out the investigations. And then they will have to, like, usually if, for example, a lawyer is present, they'll say, okay, what is it that you need to investigate further in this case? And then if the request for investigation is justified, the magistrate will then allow that person to be detained further in police custody for a further period of time that she will specify. And the magistrate can also give conditions for that remand. And the thing is, like coming back to this particular case, I don't know what did they expect to investigate for the next 7 days after she had been detained at the hospital. They already knew that she'd just delivered. They had news that she had stabbed the baby. They had an eyewitness. There was medical evidence and there was blood and everything at the scene. So what further can they investigate by remanding her for 7 days? And you could argue that it could be that they were not ready to put her under arrest yet. But again, the reason why you hold a person in remand is sometimes because they're a flight risk.
Mm-hmm.
You are worried that they might escape. And also, like, let's say they've got accomplices outside. You don't want them to be going out and, you know, doing further criminal activities. I mean, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but that's basically a very simplistic explanation of what remand is.
Mm. Now, when it was reported that the girl was remanded, now there was quite a bit of outcry over it. And then we now see also the Suhakam Children's Commissioner, Datuk Nur Razia Mohamad Awal, she released a statement saying that the girl shouldn't be detained when she might need medical and psychological treatment. Why are people worried about the fact that she was detained? What are the concerns there?
It's not so much, you see, no one is arguing or disputing the fact that a crime has been committed.
Mm-hmm.
That's there. We can't run away from that. But what we're saying is, was the process by which the child was detained and then remanded and then put in police lockup, was it necessary for them to have done it in that manner? You know, she had, you know, even ordinarily without any criminal elements in it, a woman, when she has through postpartum stress, postpartum psychological issues, and, you know, it's normal. We all have postpartum blues when we have a baby as well. So that is just in an ordinary doctor, just assisted, supported pregnancy. Here you have clearly a pregnancy that was not supported by anyone. And as a criminal element, she's murdered the baby. She stabbed her baby, according to reports. Clearly, this child, even if it was not a child, right, that person is in need of psychological support, treatment, assessment, support. For following delivery, you do need support. So the process by which, you know, from delivering a baby and then within 2 days, I think she was arrested and held under remand in police custody. I think that upset a lot of people because there was really, we've not seen any rationale for that kind of expedited action. She could have continued to be held in medical detention, been given in the hospital, been given proper medical treatments and assessments, etc., and then taken into lockup. Or even if the police felt that they needed to hold her in remand, maybe they could have worked out conditions of remand whereby she was allowed to be in the hospital as well. So I think that's the main reason why people are upset.
Mm. So there are alternatives to being remanded as she is now?
Present case, I mean, you could be detained later. It's not that we are saying she's not supposed to have been remanded or mm-hmm. detained. It's just that at this, is it correct that they had done it at this stage?
Mm. And I guess right now, you know, as someone who is in the child rights advocacy scene, what are your concerns for the girl at the moment, for her health and for her rights?
Okay, so I understand today, as of today, that she does have a lawyer. So she's got legal representation. And so I believe that she will be supported when the matter comes up for remand proceedings again on Wednesday. But I am deeply troubled and concerned about her mental health and her state of mind. I doubt that the implications of her actions have sunk in or that she understands fully what's happened. And I do believe that she does need psychological assistance. And that's my concern, that she's currently in a situation where further trauma is going to be added to her current mental state.
Mm. So there could be prolonged impact from this, right? From
Definitely.
The what's happening now, that's already affecting her, and we don't know if she doesn't receive the support that she needs,
Definitely.
This could have long-lasting
effects. And I think it's partly like, you know, we still come from a culture where it's taboo to talk about mental health. We think people are acting up when they say they need mental health assistance. And we really don't recognize that it is a health condition, just like any other health condition. And here in this case, I think the police, their primary concern was, oh my goodness, it's a big case, lots of publicity, girl got stabs her baby. We want to act fast to show that we have done what needs to be done. But at the same time, we really need to temper that with child protection and the interests of the child. I mean, in this case, you know, I'm not saying that, I'm not absolving the child of culpability, I'm not saying that she should not be held responsible for what she did, but I wonder whether she understands the implications of what she did, whether and why she did it. You know, there's research to show that neonaticide or infanticide is caused by undisclosed pregnancies and unassisted pregnancies, where the deliveries, where the delivery is done at home and nobody knows. And so the person who's delivering the baby really is in a state of panic. Oh no, what will happen if someone finds out that I've had a baby? And then the next instinct is to just get rid of the evidence. That person is not even thinking of the baby as another life form. Usually when they're teenagers, that kind of translation hasn't come in, hasn't sunk into their brains yet. So they're like thinking, how can I just get rid of this and then this problem will go? It's a teenager, she's 15, she's dropped out of school. I mean, you have to put yourself in her shoes and then you understand how serious this is.
Mm. And on top of that, you know, according to news reports, it's believed that she's a victim of sexual assault, a victim of rape, which adds another layer, another factor to consider when we're questioning what has happened, how, you know, how did events lead to this point, and how will this also impact what the child, what the teenage girl is going through right now, you know, in the midst of all these police investigations. So let's go for a quick break now, Sri, and when we come back, I want to talk about how we are tackling teenage pregnancies and baby dumping and whether we are looking at it as a social issue, as a health issue, and from a child's rights perspective as well. So I'm joined today by Srividya Ganapati, who is the chairperson, who is the co-chairperson of CRIB Foundation, and we'll continue our conversation shortly. So keep it here on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. My guest for today is Srividya Ganapati, the co-chairperson of CRIB Foundation, which stands for Child Rights, Innovation and Betterment. Now we are discussing how to tackle and address teenage pregnancies, especially from a child rights perspective, considering that, you know, that these teenagers are very much still children under the eyes of the law. We are discussing this following a news report last week that is still being talked about a 15 on the case of a 15-year-old girl who was remanded and detained after it was discovered that she had given birth and the newborn had died from stab wounds. Now, there have been quite a few statements released about this case, and one in particular was released by the Parliamentary Special Select Committee on Women, Children and Social Development. That's the one that is chaired by Pengerang MPU Azalina Osman, and that statement said that free legal representation must be provided for this teen girl and also for all children in conflict with the law. Now, as someone who comes from a legal background, could you explain why this is important? And does that mean that, you know, right now, children who find themselves in a situation where they have committed a crime, do they not receive free legal aid?
So to answer your last question first, no, currently we do not have a system in place to provide free legal representation to all children in Malaysia who are in conflict with the law. We don't have mm-hmm. such a system. We do have something called Yayasan Bantuan Guaban Kebangsaan, YBGK, mm-hmm. And that provides free legal aid to anyone who requires it in court for criminal matters, but it is not targeted at or specifically for children. And the lawyers who are YBGK lawyers also do not receive specialized treatment training to enable them to represent children in court. Now, you may say to me, but what does that mean? Why do we need trained special lawyers for children? Why can't a normal lawyer represent a child? But mm-hmm. there are specific legislations and protections in place for children, including the Child Act protections, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Evidence of a Child Witness Act, and these are all things that a lawyer needs to know before the lawyer represents a child. Similarly, communicating with a child is very different from communicating with an adult. Now, if I am a lawyer by practice, so I've got my own law firm, and if I am communicating with an adult client who comes to see me, I know how to filter what he's saying to see what part of the story that he's giving me is true and how much of it he's edited out to portray himself in a good light. And I also know like what are the ways to dig into that information to get further information. But children have social manners, number one, very different from what they are at home. Children also know how to kind of hide things when they are scared or they are in public. Mm-hmm. And really, the art of communicating with a child is actually a degree subject. It's a subject matter all by itself. I'm not saying that every lawyer who represents a child needs to go and get a degree on communicating with a child, but they need to know the basic elements of getting the basic information before you can actually say, this is my client. Even the idea, right, that my client is a child, and so my client is giving me instructions and I have to listen to my child client. Even that concept is quite difficult for a lot of lawyers to grasp. Because we're like lawyers, right? And we're like, okay, you're only 12 years old. Just listen to what I'm saying. I know what's best. Yeah, so so that kind of thing. I used to be from 2016 to 2018, I was in the Child Rights Committee of the Bar Council. So from 2016 to 2018, I was the co-chair of the Child Rights Committee of the Bar Council. And one of the projects that we did under the Child Rights Committee was we trained lawyers throughout Malaysia with a view of equipping them with the necessary training to train children in court when they are in conflict with the law. And this was based on the Canadian model, because in Canada, what happens is if you're a child and you are arrested, at the point of arrest, right? So you're arrested, you're brought back to the police station, the office of the child lawyer is already informed straight away, and a social welfare officer is also informed straight away. And these two people turn up at the police station on the day of the arrest, within a few hours of the arrest, sometimes simultaneously with the child turning up at the lockup. So from that point onwards, right, there are no communications that are happening between the police and the child without the supervision of a lawyer. And there is nothing that can happen without the social welfare officer also stepping in. And really, that's the ideal situation. That's what we want. Because we recognize that children are vulnerable and we need to give them adequate support. And we need to get that adequate support to them from the point of detention, from the point that they're arrested.
Now, the social welfare officer is an interesting one, right? Because people often think, oh, just a lawyer is sufficient. But say if we use an example of a case like this, where there is a teenage mom, there is an unwanted baby and an unwanted pregnancy, why is it important that there is a social welfare officer present as things are unfolding?
Right. So the police, their role is to investigate the crime that happened. The social welfare officer, on the other hand, is there to investigate what has happened to this child and then to figure out what are the solutions or recommendations that can best help the child. So they actually go back and they will investigate. They will interview the family, they will interview relatives or friends, they will interview the child. And ideally, they come up with a report that's cohesive, that actually informs the court, because that report should be submitted to the court, and they will inform the court, okay, in respect of this case, so this child is a product of a single mother family, her mother's not at home, so she's all alone all the time, she lives in this kind of background, she has not been able to go to school for the last don't know how many years, she has got these other issues in place. The child is generally a happy child, or the child has got problems and our relatives are reporting that she's generally depressed. You know, a proper background of the child is presented to the court. At the same time, based on the interviews that the welfare officer conducts with the family, with the child, with teachers, The welfare officer is in the best position currently in Malaysia. That welfare officer would be in the best position to kind of report back to the court and say, I would recommend this for this child. I'm not saying it's a perfect situation. I'm saying that this is something that we have now. But the thing is, we don't have enough trained welfare officers. We don't have enough trained child protectors. I think the last statistics that I've seen, and that was a few years ago, there were only 80 throughout the country. Can you imagine just 80 officers and they've got so much to do?
And if I'm not mistaken, most of them are also centered around the big cities as well, right? The more urban populated areas. So what more for the children who are in rural areas who find themselves in need of these sorts of protection, you know, when they come into conflict with the law?
Absolutely.
So now when it comes to cases like this, when it involves teenage pregnancies, when it involves teenage girls facing unwanted pregnancies, regardless of, you know, what has led to it, much has been said about it, much has been criticized. It's not uncommon, as I mentioned earlier, for us to read of news reports of these cases happening, especially when there's been a baby dumping case, right? And often, you know, when I come across these news reports, they read off as crime reports. You know, a girl was, a teenage girl found herself pregnant, didn't want the baby, and then, you know, subsequently dumped the baby. Is that something that hinders how we tackle teenage pregnancies? Because we often look at it from a criminal lens rather than a child rights lens, rather than a social issue that we need to tackle.
Absolutely. I mean, you've got it spot on. The biggest problem with teenage pregnancies in Malaysia is we kind of don't want to acknowledge that we have a problem. I don't know if you're aware, but when girls find themselves pregnant, they are expelled out of school or forced to drop out of school. They can't continue their education. Even if they're able, even if they have, they receive adequate support at home, and they want to continue their education, you know? And a lot of the times, because, see, at CRIP Foundation, one of the things that we really push for is comprehensive sex, sexuality, and reproductive education in schools for all children. We currently don't have that. We have sex education, which is very sporadic and random. It's conducted by the PE teacher during PE lessons. It's very much like a biology lesson, like body parts and it doesn't really go into what happens if you have sex, how do you have safe sex, what are the implications of pregnancy, what is statutory rape, what happens if you have sex with a girl under the age of 16. All of these things we don't teach our children in schools. And that's a problem because when children then naturally experiment, and we know from news on the ground and people who are supporting children on the ground and news that's coming from hospitals, that children as young as 10 are actively engaged in sex already. You know, we're here in 2022. We can't continue to say that we don't want to talk about sex to kids because we don't want them to have sex. That is actually the feedback that I get sometimes from some people in power, because they say, oh, you know, this is a very sensitive topic, Sri. We should not be talking about sex to children. But the thing is, whether we talk to children about sex or not, right, they are already engaging in it. And if we don't, number one, provide them with comprehensive education, and then number two, provide them with support once they get pregnant. Okay, once you get pregnant, what happens? Do you get medical health care? Can you go to a clinic Kerajaan and get pregnancy support from the government clinic? They ask you for your marriage certificate. Some government clinics have now come up with this idea of like a clinic specifically to support teen pregnancies, but it's like some secret thing. Like you need to find the password and find the door and then go through some kind of roundabout and find it. It's not like if you go to the hospital and you're pregnant and you're a teenager, you will know that there is this service that's available. It's not widely spread. It's not, the information is not given out. There's no public awareness about it. And we still think of it as a very shameful thing. And moving from there, a lot of parents feel that the only solution that their daughters have when they get pregnant is to get them married. And you know, this is really contrary to all the data out there, because the data shows that when children are married off because they're pregnant, very soon after the baby is born, they break up. You know, and the whole point of marriage is clearly, I mean, that's not the point of marriage, just to legitimize your child. But in Malaysia, that's how we, a lot of us seem to approach it. And all of these things are problematic.
But when it comes to talking about comprehensive sex or sexuality education, when it comes to talking about safe sex, a lot of the challenge there is that people think that we're encouraging children to have sex. How do you respond to that?
I've been told, you know, that, you know, when we teach children anything, a member of parliament told me this one day, and he said, I still remember, you know, when we teach children, we want them to be interested in the subject matter. How can you expect us to teach them about sex? We don't want them to be interested in sex. And I looked at him, and he said this to me, and very seriously believed in this, you know. But research shows, okay, in the Netherlands, they have comprehensive sex and sexuality and reproductive health education for all children from very, very young ages. And their rates of teen pregnancies are the lowest in the world, the lowest. So what we want to do is we want to identify problems and then we want to find solutions for problems. We really can't be mixing up policy with religion or culture, you know. Policy is about what is in the best interest of the country. Teen pregnancies is a waste of the country's resources because we have to support these children, we have to support their babies. And like scientifically, they say that the babies of educated mothers are much more successful in life than babies of teenage mothers. This is a fact. It's scientifically researched. So what we want is to bring up a citizenship that is evolved, that is developing, that is doing better. And as policymakers, government should think about how can I make my people better, basically. And that logic or that policy cannot be tempered by religion and culture. It really, really cannot. We have religious leaders for that. We have cultural leaders for that, you know. But when we are policymakers, when we are government, and we are dealing with the entire country, we have to think about what's the best for my people.
Mm. And ultimately, in this case, what's the best for the teenager, right? What sort of support they need?
Yes, for all teenagers. And not just this specific child mm-hmm. who managed to hit the headlines, but for every child. There's so many cases of baby dumping that are happening out there. Mm-hmm. If you speak to JKM officers, they will tell you horror stories of babies that are found with the, you know, chewed up. It's horrific. We need to stop it.
Mm. There are so many barriers, isn't it? First of all, even to talk about comprehensive sex or sexuality education, it's considered a sensitive topic. There are, unfortunately, a lot of cultural and religious stigma towards talking about sex, towards talking about consent. And then the stigma then continues on if, you know, a teenage girl happens to be pregnant and the entirety of the stigma is on the girl herself who has to face it from society and sometimes even from family members, because so often we hear about cases where the pregnancy was not even disclosed to family members.
Yes, and the thing that we forget, a lot of people forget, is that teen pregnancies is actually a health problem. It's not an MOE, Ministry of Education problem. It's a Ministry of Health problem because they have to deal with the labor, with the delivery, with the premature child, with the vaccinations for the baby, with the baby dumping, with the teenage mother's health. So it's very much a health problem, and there shouldn't be stigma attached to it. It should just be a matter of fact thing. What is it? You have diabetes. Okay, go see this doctor. What is it? You have teen pregnancies. Okay, go see these people. And this is how you support it. That's how we should be approaching it. We shouldn't talk about it in terms of sensitivity or religion or culture. We are in 2022. We have to be progressive.
But do you still see that as a huge hurdle, the reluctance to talk about this issue?
I have to tell you, Sue-Ann, that I have always wondered how we're going to get over this. Mm-hmm. But then the PSSC's recommendations that came by on Sunday mm-hmm. totally blew me away. I'm so impressed that the Parliamentary Special Select Committee by themselves have recommended for comprehensive sex and sexuality and reproductive health. education. I believe that this is like a huge leap forward for Malaysia and child rights in Malaysia. And, you know, I'm so thankful for that statement. And I think that, you know, things are looking a little brighter for me.
Hmm. You know, moving forward, what sort of changes would you like to see? And would you have a final message to listeners in terms of how can we do better to support girls, especially who find themselves in situations like this recent case with an unwanted pregnancy, who when they don't know where to go for support?
One of the things is I would say to listeners that, you know, what I would like is for you not to have to deal with teen pregnancies, but to actually speak candidly to your children about sex and sexuality, talk to them about safe sex, you know, the fact that you acknowledge the fact that children are having sex. It's so hard to accept, but how are you going to protect your child from teen pregnancies? This is the question that you have to ask yourself, not how are you going to protect your child from sex. You're not going to be able to do that, I'm afraid. Okay. And in terms of my recommendations, I would think that I would echo the PSSC's recommendations, but I would also say that what we also need is a multi-agency approach to how we deal with child rights and child protection in this country. The police must work hand in hand with the hospitals, and the hospitals must work hand in hand with the judiciary and lawyers. You know, we all have, at the moment, the problem that we are facing is everybody is working in silos. Everybody is doing their own thing. And a lot of those things are very good things. Mm-hmm. But it would be better if we work together.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sri.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I've been speaking to Srividya Ganapati, co-chairperson of CRIB Foundation, which stands for Child Rights Innovation and Betterment. And Sri has been talking to me about how we need to not take a criminal approach to tackling teen pregnancies and baby dumping, or in some cases, infanticide, but rather to really address it, to really address the root causes and the problem from a health and human rights-centered approach, so that we are providing the necessary support for the teenagers, so that the young teen girls who find themselves in such situations know where to find support and are not afraid to do so. Now, if you missed any part of today's show or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can listen to our shows on bfm.my or on the BFM app. I'm Lim Suen, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.